for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Throughout 2008 and 2009, as the global economy fell into deep recession, Greg Easterbrook worked on a book saying prosperity is about to make its next big leap. Easterbrook is the author of six previous books, including The Progress Paradox. The Wall Street Journal describes him as a contrarian. Greg Easterbrook joins me in the studio to talk about his latest book. It's titled Sonic Boom. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us through Facebook and Twitter. Well, Greg, it's good to see you again.
Thank you, Diane.
Tell me what it was like for you working on this book while your editors, everybody around you must have been saying, Greg, what are you talking about?
Oh, I certainly heard from my editors at Random House on this. I'd spent several years doing the research and traveling around and interviewing people. And as I sat down to write in late 2007, the recession began. So here I am writing a book predicting a huge increase in global prosperity when everyone around me is predicting a new depression. And it's probably a healthy thing to question your own sanity at times. But more important for me as a writer and the content of the book, I think it helped discipline the book because it forced me to confront the arguments against my own positions and my own opinions.
But it would seem that the thesis for your book had been designed before this global collapse began.
Yes, and I still remain confident that a next wave of prosperity is coming. Here's basically why. History shows us that when some crisis interrupts a larger trend, when the crisis fades, the larger trend resumes. Before the financial meltdown of 2007, the larger trend was very rapid increase in global prosperity, positive increases in freedom, education levels around the world, rising communication, interconnectedness, the rates of growth in India and China especially were almost hard to believe. And then a financial crisis came and stopped everything in its tracks. The financial crisis is now fading. We hope it will end soon. And I think then the larger trend will resume. Rapid growth, more freedom, more education, more information.
At the same time, you've got something called war going on.
Yes, but you look at the statistics, and I go through the statistics in detail in Sonic Boom. Iraq, Sudan, Afghanistan are terrible exceptions to a larger rule, which is declining combat internationally. The last 20 years, fewer wars, fewer casualties from war. Your chance of dying in combat now is the lowest it's ever been in human history. Now, that's only 20 years. Maybe that's too little to draw conclusions from. But the last 20 years, superpower relations have been relatively warm, not cold, and the world combat deaths have been down.
So why do you use the word sonic in your title?
Well, I think another boom is coming, but I'm not a Pollyanna. I think it's a sonic boom. It's going to be loud, discordant. It's going to drive us all crazy. I think to the same extent that prosperity will continue to rise, mainly in the developing world, not so much here, but the developing world means so much more to the larger ethical picture than what happens in the United States means. But at the same time, it's going to be loud, crazy. It's going to get on our nerves. It's going to give us all headaches. I think the world will continue to get more zany and anxiety-inducing than it is today.
How come?
I think because we won't. The pace of change is accelerating. You look at the accelerating pace of change in China. It's almost mind-bending right now. Pace of change is accelerating in the United States. People have been predicting, actually, you go back for several hundred years, that the pace of change would overwhelm humanity's ability to comprehend it. Hasn't really happened yet. But maybe it will happen. Maybe the pace of change will overwhelm us in economics and culture and everything.
Is China a good example of that?
Well, you look at the larger picture, what's most important in China is that they are haltingly moving toward freedom. It's halting, but at least they're moving in the right direction. And they've lifted 200 million people out of poverty in a single generation, almost the entire population of this country. China has all kinds of problems in human rights, environment, etc. But just a generation ago, there were hundreds of millions of people there living in abject poverty. And now the abject poverty statistics for China are way down. That's the thing that seems most important to me.
You've also got, as of today, the headlines about Google threatening to pull out of China because they fear that what's happened is that they have been sort of cyber spied on.
Yes. The Chinese government is still far from a democracy. It's still a scary government to us in many ways, and probably most important to the average person in China, it's still a corrupt government. But I think they're generally moving in the right direction. And the fact that think about superpower relations in the past. The history of superpower relations is that they are antagonistic and based on military competition. There's no military competition between the United States and China. It's all economic. Economic competition has all kinds of problems. It drives us crazy, but it is 1,000 times better than military competition. And I'd rather have that any day. I'd rather have our problems with China be based on Google and General Electric than I would be based on the Seventh Fleet.
So you see that all these companies are going to be affected by rapidly changing technology, for example.
Yes, technological change, I think, will continue to accelerate. For example, globalization, if globalization is driving you crazy, I think globalization has barely started, that the globalization effects mainly lie in the future, for good or ill, more prosperity, cheaper products, et cetera, but also more insecurity. Network effects, 10 years ago, people got bored with talking about network effects from computers. I think most network effects lie in the future. Most people in the world are not yet networked. When they are, the number of brains in the world that are applied to problems will increase exponentially.
How much of the world is connected now by technology?
Estimates usually range to 1 billion to maybe a little more than 1 billion people. And it is realistic to think that by the middle of this century, pretty much everybody will be technologically connected.
And how could that affect us?
Well, there'll be a lot of downside. A lot of things will drive us crazy about it.
Such as?
Job anxiety is going to get worse. I wish I could tell you better, but it's just going to get worse. Things are going to seem ever more inferior. It's a hard word to pronounce every day. I think cultures will get more and more like each other. A lot of people aren't going to like that. Think of the social variation you would have encountered if you took a horseback trip from Paris to Istanbul 200 years ago. If you take a car trip from Paris to Istanbul 50 years in the future, you're not going to encounter much variation. Those things will drive people crazy. But at the same time, knowledge will increase, freedom will increase, goods and services will become higher in quality, lower in cost, will continue to reduce poverty throughout the world. Those are all pluses.
But what about human beings and the way they relate to each other?
I actually think that's in a long-term trend of improvement, too. You can call me a cockeyed optimist, but I think that I was born in 1953. At that time, the United States was racked with every kind of prejudice that you can imagine, against women, blacks, gays, everything. Prejudice was a norm in society then. Now prejudice is a source of shame in our society. Now we're trying to break down our barriers of prejudice against other parts of the world. That's kind of the next project. I think as people communicate with each other better and see each other and know each other, and as our jobs increasingly require us to get along with people on other continents who we normally would know nothing about, I think fears of other cultures will break down. And I think gradually we will like each other more.
You really believe that?
Diane, compare the United States of today to the United States of 1953. Which country would you rather live in?
Well, my point being, even around the world today, we continue to see people within countries, within communities, killing each other.
Of course, yes.
And you're saying that 50 years from now, you see that diminishing substantially.
I think it's diminishing today. First, we have rapid decline in combat deaths around the world. It's only been 20 years, so that could change. But combat deaths are rapidly declining. You look at the history of our society and nations is one of conflict, combat, wars. Look at the history of Europe, endless war after endless war. Europe has now gone 60 years without any kind of combat or fighting. I think it's possible that this will happen for most of the world and that economic interconnectedness will cause it to happen. We have countries are now more interested in seizing market share than in seizing territory. It's true that people in the past have predicted that economic interconnectedness would stop war, and we know what happened in World War I, right? But I think the general trend is toward interconnectedness making people less hostile to each other. And we see these spectacular exceptions and horrible ones of terrorism or all kinds of political hatred in other countries, including here. I think they only involve a very small minority of people. And the main trend is toward tolerance of others.
And, of course, you're also looking at economic forecasts that had been made earlier. For example, 10, 15 years ago, people thought everything was going to continue to go up without the downturn we've seen.
Yes, there have been some people in the past who have predicted nothing but sunny skies and golden results, and I certainly wouldn't predict that. I have no idea what's going to happen in the year 2010, whether we'll be happier at the end of the year than we are right now. I couldn't pretend to tell you that.
But on the other hand, people will, I'm sure, want to say to you, what are you basing all this on? Is it your own study of what's happening in the world, or is it your own personal belief?
A little bit of both. What's happening in the world, global prosperity has risen substantially in your lifetime and mine. If you adjust for inflation, China's has five times the prosperity that it had 30 years ago. India has three times the prosperity, etc. These are magnificent achievements.
Greg Easterbrook, his new book is titled Sonic Boom, Globalization at Max Speed. We've got lots of callers for you, Greg Easterbrook, on your ideas, your theories about what's going to happen in the economic world to come. Your new book is titled Sonic Boom, Globalization at Max Speed. Let's go first to Fort Matilda, Pennsylvania. Good morning, Sarah. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just want to take issue with one of the comments you made earlier.
Sure.
That China doesn't really pose much of a military threat to us. I mean, perhaps not in the traditional sense, but my opinion is that China does not respect intellectual property rights. And whether you're talking about something as innocuous as creative content or more important things like the business model for Google, they're actively trying to hack into our products, even our military, security, our power grids, all those things. And so it may not be the traditional sense, but I think, to say that they don't pose a military threat is a grave underestimation.
Greg.
China's a society of 1.2 billion people that one generation ago was one of the worst places on earth in terms of abject poverty, in terms of dictatorship, lack of freedom, etc., threat to the world. In the last generation that we've started to become globally interconnected, most trends in China have been positive. Poverty is declining, halting steps in the direction of freedom, no direct military confrontation.
Contradictory steps in the direction of freedom, wouldn't you say?
It's a complex society.
Yeah.
All of the great ideas of the Enlightenment are being tested in China in a single generation. It took 500 years for the ideas of the Enlightenment to shake themselves out in Europe. And nobody would be so foolish as to claim that everything's fine in China.
And, of course, the fact that Google has been there at all would support your argument. Sarah, do you want to comment?
Well, I just think that, you know, creative and the business model, like all those things that Google brings to the market, the products, you know, something like that is emblematic of, I think, a very serious threat, really, by China, that when they don't respect intellectual property, you know, it's not a way for us to operate on a level playing field with our businesses. I mean, it's great that we have a chance to go over there, but, you know, is it really for real? Because it doesn't seem like it's a level playing field.
Thanks for calling.
I would agree with your caller in the sense that there are all kinds of problems in doing business in China. And from our perspective, they're trying to cheat on a number of things. But I would far rather the competition in the United States and China, the two superpowers of the world, be over intellectual property and software and production than over nuclear missiles and navies.
All right. To Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Neil.
Yeah, Mr. Easterbrook was saying that there are fewer combat deaths. I know Steve Pinker has made this argument, and it's based on other people's research, that violence is decreasing. But are they counting in those statistics the civilians blown up in suicide bombings, which kill, you know, dozens of people at a time instead of someone with a knife or even a handgun killer?
Well, and of course, it's not just suicide bombings. It's
correct.
What the U.S. inflicted on Iraq and Afghanistan.
So the real point is counting any in any context requires a very careful definition or the numbers are meaningless.
Well, and the answer is yes, I do count those numbers. The statistics cited in the book, which presented in great detail, I'll refer you to them, count non-traditional combat situations, terrorism. They count not just the results of active warfare, but the results of economic blockades, such as the one we imposed on Iraq, which surely led to thousands of civilian deaths. They count everything. And you count everything, and you still come up with declining civilian deaths from combat.
And, of course, the other point is that the extrapolation indefinitely into the future with a linear model is a hazardous approach to predicting the future.
Oh, I have no idea what's going to happen in the future. And as I said before, 20 years may be too short a time. Obviously, something terrible can happen. All I know is that during the same period that the world has become more economically interconnected, combat deaths have gone down. We can hope those two things are related.
Thanks for calling, Neil. And on the economic front, hasn't globalization created huge problems for cities here in the United States?
Well, yes, but you have to ask yourself, compared to what? Suppose there hadn't been obviously, globalization has problems. A third of my book is describing the problems caused by globalization. But suppose we hadn't had globalization. Suppose trade barriers had stayed high. Suppose China, India, and Russia had remained closed economies as they were a generation ago. United States economic growth would almost certainly be much slower.
Why?
Because so much of our economy is based on trade with other nations. If we weren't trading with other nations, would our economic growth have been 2.5 times in the last 30 years when you adjust for inflation? Would our standard of living be so high here? Maybe. It's possible. I can tell you, I feel certain, all this possible that the United States would still be fine without globalization. I feel certain that developing countries would not be as well off as they are. And most of the people in the world live in developing countries. Most of the tragedies of the world occur in developing countries. I don't think anybody can argue that globalization, for all its problems, has not reduced poverty in the developing world. And that's really more important than what happens in Pittsburgh in the United States, right? Even though Pittsburgh's important.
See, I think that's where, you know, I and perhaps some of our listeners might take issue with you. In that, you know, I understand the world is a huge place, but when you think about people whose jobs are completely gone in this country because globalization has taken place and free trade has taken place, you really, it takes the long term to see that there will be some equilibrium at some point.
Sure. So let's think about the long term. Right now we have 10% unemployment, which is terrible. The single worst thing going on in the United States right now is the unemployment rate. We've had similar levels of unemployment in the past, post-war, when there was no globalization. So we know that the American economy is plagued with boom and bust cycles. This is a fundamental problem with our economy.
True.
But let's again think, what if we hadn't have had globalization? If you're an auto worker, if you work in the appliance manufacturing business, there are three or four, if you're in the steel business, jobs are way down. But jobs would have been way down without trade or not.
Why?
Changes in productivity and technology. About 90% of factory reduction has occurred because of technology, not because of international trade. Would have recurred if Toyota had never existed. There would be fewer people making cars in the United States than there were before. Everybody sympathizes. I'm glad I'm not an auto worker who lost his job. And if I was, I'd be furious about it. But some auto workers were going to lose their jobs anyway. And the overall increase in prosperity helps everybody else.
All right. Let's go to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Good morning, Brian.
How you doing? Yeah, I generally agree with them that I think with technology and prosperity in other countries, I think overall in the bigger picture, I think it is going that direction, and technology will probably lead us there. The one thing I wanted to point out is what we got a little bit of that in the last hour with maybe the healthcare, but there's one thing that we don't want to quite admit is, you know, we're a 20th of the population of the planet, and we use anywhere between a quarter and a third of the resources, and we're going to have to start sharing that, and it's, you know, like the Me Too, you know, China and India and all these are saying, hey, we want that too. And we know with the oil, China wanting oil and India wanting more oil and just everything in general, it's got to be spread out more. And it's a factor we don't like to admit, but we're going to have to cut our standard of living if we want the rest of the world to share too. And it's just a matter of fact.
And that's the downside.
Well, and actually, I would turn that around and say the fact that we have 4% of the world, we United States have 4% of the world's population use 20% of current resources doesn't tell you that our resource use goes down. It tells you that the rest of the world's resource use has to go way up, which is what we're seeing in the developing world.
But doesn't ours have to go down as the rest of the world's goes up?
No, I don't think it has to. I think our use of resources should become much more clean, especially in the energy sector. I think that's essential, but that would be true regardless of where the rest of the world was. The main thing that's going on is that the rest of the world's resource use is increasing. It's a gigantic management problem. All the estimates show electricity production in the world has to double in the next 50 years, assuming big increases in conservation. Doubling the world's output of electricity at the same time that we're trying to combat greenhouse gases is a fantastically complex problem. And one point I make in Sonic Boom is that we're not only going to have an accelerating rate of change in the economy that would happen regardless of other forces, we're going to have it while there is climate change. It's going to be a double whammy of stress.
Let's go to Statesville, North Carolina. Hi, Max. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. So my question kind of ties the resource use issue in with the connectivity. If everyone had access to some form of media, if everyone, like you said, would have access to the internet or some other media outlet, they'd also be exposed to marketing, you know, for products, you know, they don't necessarily need. And, you know, this increased demand and production of these things would use up a lot of resources.
I have a chapter on this very thing. As I said, not a Pollyanna. I don't claim that everything's good. Many things that drive us crazy are going to become more efficient in the future. Advertising, political consulting, the whole culture of making people dissatisfied with what they possess, it's becoming mechanically more efficient all the time with zip code analysis and other similar things. And that's going to get worse, and it's going to lead to stress.
So in regard to healthcare, for example, as you were writing this book, here comes President Obama with his proposal. Of course, he didn't have one himself, but they're dealing with healthcare. Do you think we're moving in the right direction?
Yes, there has to be fundamental change in healthcare.
But is what we're seeing fundamental enough? And that's what everybody wants to know.
Diane, I wish I understood what was in the Senate bill.
Yeah.
I admit that I don't. Do you understand it?
Nope.
Right. The point I make in the book is that there are some things that are going to happen in the future, mainly economic stress, that we simply can't stop. We can stop healthcare stress. And when you look at the core difference between the United States and European Union, both academic surveys and anecdotal evidence shows that Europeans experience less stress in their lives than Americans do. And you know, maybe it's because they drink wine in cafes. I don't think that's, maybe we should do more of that. I think the real reason is that Europeans don't worry about their health care, and we do. So that has to change. That is a source of stress that we can eliminate.
What about Japan? What about their health care system?
Well, the Japanese health care system is what a lot of people in America would like to move towards. Japan itself has had a pretty rocky 20 years.
Yep.
I mean, and when people talk about China, remember 20 years ago, that I'm sure there must have been a guest on your program who said, well, Japan's going to take over the world.
Absolutely.
We'll be the number one.
Absolutely.
And now we're all saying, man, we're glad we don't live in Japan.
Yeah.
So today people say, well, China's going to take over the world.
Of course.
China will be number one.
Yeah.
And I find this to be just as unrealistic. America is going to be the main thing happening in the world all throughout your lifetime and mine.
Somebody sent me an email saying that the Japanese probably live longer, not so much because they eat in more healthy ways, but because they do have good health care coverage.
They do, and that's probably a factor. If you look at studies of comparative life satisfaction and happiness between nations, and Carol Graham of Brookings has just written a really nice book about this. You should have her on. You look at what nations are happy and what nations are miserable. Japan's right at the bottom. I mean, they feel that, yes, they live longer than we do, but they describe their lives as misery. So,
Greg Easterbrook, and the book we're talking about is titled Sonic Boom. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Williamsburg, Virginia. Good morning, Peter. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. I tend to believe that a number of our problems in the world are based on overpopulation. Back in the 70s, we were very vocal about overpopulation. We don't hear too much about it anymore. You've already kind of touched on the resources issue and how we're delving into them, but I wonder if you could speak to that a little further and where you think that we're going to go with overpopulation and what the impact is going to be, and if there's anything that we can do about it.
Well, do about it. The global population has almost doubled in the last 35 years. 3 billion people added to the human family. The previous 3 billion people took, you know, how many hundreds of thousands of years? Now we have 3 billion more. And yet, if you take United Nations statistics, most of those people were added into the great global middle class. Of the 3 billion added in the last 35 years, 1.9 billion of them are middle class globally. So almost all outside the United States, not inside. How is it possible to add so many people so fast without a great increase in impoverishment? And I think it's the rate of economic growth. If you're worried about rising population and continuing rising global population is cast in stone for the next 2 to 3 decades, we have to have a rapid level of economic growth or the new people joining the human family will be impoverished.
So you don't see any effort on the part of other societies trying to limit the growth of population?
Well, China famously has tried to do that, and they were...
And they've turned around on this.
Their success, their Chinese fertility rate is now 1.8 per woman, so they're already below replacement rate in China. Most nations are already below replacement rate. So if population worries me, too. Now, there are all these Malthusian estimates that we'd all starve to death. That hasn't happened, but it could happen. We could reach the point where the Earth can no longer carry more billions of people. But then you ask yourself, well, what force will oppose this? I mean, what do you propose? Do you propose mandatory sterilization or other crazy stuff? The thing that has caused birth rates to come down voluntarily is education for women. And education for women occurs in societies that are engaged in international trade. So you look at the places in the world where birth rates are voluntarily declining, they're the globalized places. And the places where the birth rates are still going up, they're the places that are holdouts.
Peter, does that answer your question?
Well, I'm still concerned about the rate of consumption of our resources, and I was hoping you could address that. How long is our current population sustainable?
That might be the biggest of all big questions. 30 years ago, many predictions of exhaustion of petroleum and natural gas. Now we have larger petroleum and natural gas reserves than we had 30 years ago. My personal guess about petroleum and natural gas is that it will never be exhausted, in the sense that we will replace it with other forms of energy before we run out of it.
What about water?
Water's a much bigger concern, actually. You're right on the beam there, Diane. China's agricultural miracle has been premised on the very rapid pumping of groundwater. Mm-hmm. And China's going to run into groundwater problems a lot sooner than the world runs into other primary resource
problems. And you see, here you've got exploration for gas, for example, in rock shales and the like, and they're contaminating groundwater.
Yes, it's not something I would worry about for the United States, but for China, for most of the Middle East, Egypt especially has groundwater supply issues, not just contamination, but supply. There are places in the world where groundwater is a real concern.
All right, we'll take just a short break, and when we come back, more of your questions, comments for Greg Easterbrook. His new book is titled Sonic Boom. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. By the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. This is NPR.
I used to be somebody, but now I am somebody else.
In the new film Crazy Heart, Jeff Bridges plays a washed-up, alcoholic country singer. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with singer-songwriter and producer T-Bone Burnett about co-writing songs for Bridges to sing. Burnett produced many movie soundtracks, including Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Join us.
Greg Easterbrook, yesterday on this program, we were talking about California, what's happening there in terms of Governor Schwarzenegger declaring that California needs money from the federal government, that its education programs are suffering. What do you see going on there?
Well, whether states should be financed by federal borrowing is kind of a separate fiscal policy discussion. The larger point that I would want to make is, as we look to the future, education will become steadily more important. It's very short-sighted to cut spending on education, which is fundamentally an investment, while increasing spending subsidies for politically powerful interest groups, which has been the last 10 years Republican and Democrat in the United States. You think back to the 19th century. One of the great achievements of the second half of the 19th century was the public education movement, making universal public high school education to the age of 16. Started in Germany, flowered here. One of the great things America did for the world was universal public education. If you adjust for life expectancy to today, universal public education should extend to the age of 23. That's a college education. And I think our goal has to be universal college education so that people don't get left behind by tides of economic changes.
Here's an email from Stefan. He says, as an historian, I've heard all this before. 100 years ago, the major nations of Europe had been at peace since 1870. The airplane was going to bring people together and promote peace. A major war would be so costly that no nation would contemplate it. The Roaring Twenties were supposed to be the start of continuous prosperity. Why should I believe your guest any more than I would believe the failed prophets of the past?
Well, Stefan, first, you didn't listen earlier in the show when we were discussing pre-World War I debate just that you mentioned. If you want to listen to a radio show on which someone says something that no one has ever said before, I don't have that station on my dial. I'm sorry.
I don't understand that. Say more about
that. Okay, I don't seem to be dismissive of that question. Of course the past is full of failed prophecies. You can also find failed prophecies in the past of destruction of the world. We have lots of failed prophecies of destruction, gloom and doom, collapse of society. We have lots of failed prophecies of total utopia, H.G. Wells and others, of approximately the era that Stefan refers to. We're famous utopians. They believe that by now we would live in a physical utopia. The past is full of failed prophecies. And I would guess that of statements of the present, 99% will turn out not to be correct. I don't claim to know what the future holds. I do think that it is reasonable to expect that the past trend of global prosperity will resume, and at the same time that our anxiety about it will increase. Those are the core contentions of my book.
Here's an email from Adam in Kent, Ohio. How do Africans and the majority of that continent fit into your ideas of a prosperity boom?
If you want things to worry about in the world, I worry about that an atomic bomb's going to go off somewhere. That issue is kind of off the radar. And I worry about Central Africa. It's hard to imagine what the good outcome for Central Africa is, at least within our lifetimes. Maybe over the course of many generations, things will be fine there. But Central Africa, everything that could possibly be wrong is wrong.
All right, let's go to Salt Lake City. Good morning, Kara. You're on the air.
Thanks, Diane. It's great to talk to you. My comment is just going back to something that you said when you took issue with Mr. Easterbrook, saying that, you know, globalization has taken jobs from people in Pittsburgh, for example. And I thought it was interesting, your comment, because I think that we might be dealing more with a question of semantics there, because while a job in Pittsburgh is taken by globalization, you could also say it that a job in Pittsburgh was taken by someone in a developing country.
Yes.
And while, of course, you know, I've actually experienced layoff with my husband in the past year, so I have been one of those people. But I would say that our country, I would have to assume that our country can absorb these people losing jobs in Pittsburgh better than a developing country can absorb another hungry mouth.
Well,
I'm curious what your comment might be.
I hope you're right. And you do believe she's right, do you, Greg?
Sure, but let's step back and place it in historical perspective. Right now we're in the phase of the human experiment when heavy manufacturing is in decline everywhere, not just in the United States. We've lost 6 million heavy manufacturing jobs in the United States in the last 30 years. China has lost 28 million. It's not because the jobs fled to China. It's because technology is changing the way we create physical objects and requiring fewer people. And this would have happened regardless. Look back, this is not caused by globalization. You look back 100 years ago, at that time, 72% of Americans worked in the agricultural sector. Today, 2%. 100 years ago, the thought that only 2% of people would have jobs in the agricultural sector, you would say, my God, the world is going to end. And in fact, we're much better off, including farmers, are much better off today than before that transition.
So you're saying that even as far as the car industry is concerned, that technology would have taken many of those jobs away in this country, and that even in Japan or China, producing automobiles, you're going to do it with far fewer people because of technology.
Yes, study shows that about 90% of heavy manufacturing job loss is caused by improving technology, not by competition. And do we want to ban technology? Maybe we could, but suppose we had. If we'd banned improvements in automobile technology in the 1950s, we'd all be driving finned Cadillacs with no seat belts and 5 miles per gallon now.
Kara, I'm glad you called. Let's go to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Charles.
Yeah, hi, Diane.
Hi.
I just want to comment on your guest's, position of how globalization is going to lead to higher prosperity. This is an argument, a position that's been brought up by Thomas Friedman as well. And, if anyone really takes an honest look at these economics, they don't add up for the majority of the people in the world. I mean, to think that open economies or quote-unquote free trade is going to lead to greater prosperity and freedom, take a look at Dubai, Singapore, or even China or Thailand, for that matter. Neither of these places are bastions of freedom. Capitalism does not go hand in hand with democracy. China is a great example of that. And I think if you looked at the favelas of Brazil, the shanty towns on the border of South Texas and Mexico, I would say NAFTA is a complete failure for the majority of the working class.
Well, again, I think you have to ask yourself the compared to what question. I'm not saying, and I don't know of any rational person who says that globalization answers all questions or that everything will be fine or anything like that. But suppose that the liberalization of international trade had not occurred. So we're roughly in the condition of, say, 1980. That's pretty much a good year to peg it at. We would have 200 million more people in poverty in China than we have today. We would have, according to UN statistics, 1.2 to 1.3 billion more people in poverty globally. We would still have China as a closed society and a dictatorship. India would still be a fundamentally closed society. Russia would still be a closed society. You don't say everything now is fine, or everything's going to be great, or things are going to be wonderful, blah, blah, blah. Just say compare. The trend has been mainly positive, and do you want to interfere with that trend?
So are you also saying that you believe always that economic advance goes hand in hand with political freedom?
So far, that's been observed. Whether that will always be true, I don't have any way of knowing. And there's a separate argument that I think your caller alludes to about whether capitalism is the best organizing principle for economics or not. That's an argument for the future. Capitalism is obviously a flawed system. It's only the best thing we've got today. And I would hope that in the future there will be some much more serene and more equitable way to organize the world. But what is that way? We don't know what that way is yet. For the moment, if you say, well, let's turn back the clock and not have trade liberalization, I think that would set back the world in a major way, and most importantly would set back the poor of the developing world.
All right. To Scotty in Indianapolis. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Show. I'm hopeful that the gentleman is correct. I just had a question about that Peter alluded to earlier with population growth as well as resources. It always seemed like an oxymoron to me to talk about the concept of sustainable growth. It may not have been so intuitive 100 years ago, but it seems that if you have finite resources and finite space, that growth eventually can't be sustainable. And I wonder if we could just talk a little bit about where that plays in and where do we start to reach our limits, and have we not already started to reach some of them in terms of existence in a way that is a pleasant way to live as opposed to just a surviving way to live.
And, of course, somebody a while back wrote a book titled The Limits of Growth.
Right, and we certainly haven't reached them yet. Will we someday? I think that limits of resources trouble me the least of all these concerns.
Why?
Except for groundwater in China.
Yeah.
We're not even close to the resource limit for fossil energy. I almost sort of wish we were, because it would speed the transition to clean fuel. But we're not even close. Primary metals, we're not even close to the resource limit. I think what we are more close to is the limit of society's ability to manage the rate of expansion of the global economy. That worries me a lot more. Take the example of China's most important example. 1.2 billion people in China, less than 10% of them have cars. 50%, 60%, 70%, maybe 100% of Chinese are going to end up having cars. It's not the resources that will power that worries me. It's the physical management of the movement of those cars, the pollution they create, et cetera. I think those are much greater long-term issues. So you look at these things in comparison with human population growth. Obviously, we all wish that human population growth would stop, but it won't. I mean, what's your proposal for stopping human population growth? Over the course of the century, it will stop. And the United Nations already predicts that 2 centuries from now, the human population will be smaller than it is today. But in the time that you and I are alive, the human population is going to keep growing.
On what basis does the UN make that prediction?
UN Demographic Agency has been very close to its population projections for the last 40 years, close to within a few percentage points. And they now project that human population is going to peak around 9 billion, a number that is very difficult to fathom, 50% more than we have in the world today.
Yeah,
very difficult to fathom.
Yeah.
Where are they going to go? Where are they going to sit? Where are they going to park their cars? Hard to imagine. But by 200 years from now, the human population will have declined to 4.3 billion. That's simply if you project out fertility trends. Remember, Dan, America is already below replacement rate for native-born Americans. We have population growth only because of immigration. Most of Europe's below replacement rate. Russia's below it. China's now below it. This won't matter to your lifetime or mine, but several generations down the road, the human population will begin to decline, unless there's some huge breakthrough in longevity, in which case all bets are off.
All bets could be off. Indeed, the book we're talking about, Sonic Boom, Globalization at Max Speed. Greg Easterbrook is the author, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And now to Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi there, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a business strategist. I've been involved with outsourcing offshore for many years. And I saw the creation of the industry offshore as a result of tight U.S. immigration policies and the availability of cash to create telecom and infrastructure offshore. So I guess what I'm wondering is, in the future, are we going to continue to see our government, meddle in free market policy or try to fix what they've done and get out? Because I would expect that if we continue down this track, we're going to see cause and effect continue in globalization, the job loss in America continue to grow.
I would say that the government policy, although important, worries me less than other things. There's no master control room from which the economy is run. In fact, I think one reason we feel so much anxiety about the economy is that nobody's in charge of the economy. The president's certainly not in charge of the economy. There isn't anybody running the economy. It's running itself. And that's why it's so anxiety-inducing. So I don't, U.S. fiscal policy and regulatory policy, certainly both those things matter, but I don't see those as major concerns in the larger scheme.
And finally, to Birmingham, Alabama. Good morning, Frankie.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure, go right ahead.
I have a question for your guest there. How does a man's ingenuity regarding stem cell research, surrogacy, and cloning affect the outcome of humanity regarding the future, as well as diseases such as bird flu and swine flu? And I'll hang up and I'll listen for your
All right, program. Thanks.
Well, those are separate subjects, but there's tremendous potential in biotechnology. There's also tremendous room for pitfalls. I think we should move very cautiously, because what we are is biological. We shouldn't alter biology casually.
But it's being done.
Being done, and it could have
being done.
It could have benefits. And I think, Diane, because we tend to focus on bad news, and most of our discussion today is focused on what should we worry about, what's wrong, what's bad, we tend to lose benefits, track of benefits when we talk of all of this stuff. Reduction of jobs for auto workers has been a personal tragedy for auto workers, but at the same time, it's caused overall affluence to rise in society as a whole. We have more teachers as a result, more healthcare workers. The march of progress, mainly a march, creates a lot of benefits that we now instantly take for granted and only worry about what could go wrong. And
Well, one of the things that has gone wrong, one of the things that continues to go wrong, is a certain element of greed within our own society. And the extent to which that's going to continue and perhaps affect your thoughts about Sonic Boom.
You're not going to like this, but I say in Sonic Boom that I think that social inequality is going to get worse. I don't like it. The rich are, we're all offended by these Wall Street guys who get $100 million bonuses for pressing buttons, but I think it's going to get worse. And I think the
Do you think it's going to get worse? Simply because it can?
That would be the main reason, yes. I'm not sure how you would regulate this away without causing harm to the rest of the economy. That's my big concern. Confiscatory taxes wouldn't do it. If you try the thought experiment that I offer in the book is, suppose we took CEOs who currently now make 2,700 times the average worker's wage, cap the wage at 100 times, still a lot, still a great incentive to be a CEO, works out to about $1.4 million a year, 100 times the average worker's wage. And then the only way a CEO could raise his pay would be to raise the average worker's wage. I think solutions to it are possible, but are they going to happen this year?
I doubt it. Yeah. Greg Easterbrook, his new book is titled Sonic Boom. We'll be watching, Greg. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.